Okay, let's get started. So, here's an ungraded pop quiz. So, think of this as a perfect heuristic for some random problem, okay, where x-axis are all the nodes, just written n1 all the way to n infinity, okay, and y-axis is the value of the heuristic there. Okay, and this thing in red is the perfect heuristic. Okay, first question: are there any goal nodes that I'm showing there? Why?
Never hits the x-axis.
Never hits the x-axis. You know, I made this picture and I was very happy, but then you know I realized that you need to touch the you know x-axis for it to have goal node. So I converted the bug into a feature. So yeah, in this particular case, yes, there are no goal nodes being shown, but if I keep going, I guess there may be some goal nodes, okay? But you know, try to answer it with respect to just what we have here. The second question is, I have a heuristic H1. Is this admissible? Assume for now that it ends here, so, you know, so is it admissible? Okay? Heuristic 5, is that admissible? If you do search with H5 versus H1, where do you think you will do more work in terms of the number of node expansions? H1. Where do you get optimality guarantee? With which of these will you get optimality guarantee? That means when you're done, you're guaranteed to be optimal. H star, the only one? H1, too. Because admissibility gives you optimality guarantee, okay? H4, admissible, not admissible. Why? It crosses H star in one place. Now, are you guaranteed that if you search with H4, you will always get inoptimal solutions? No. You're only guaranteed that you can't be sure that you have optimal solutions. Optimal, the admissibility is a sufficient but not necessary condition. But for optimality, you want sufficient conditions because it's not enough to say I may be optimal. Okay. Sometimes when you run with the inadmissible heuristics, you may luck out and get optimal solutions. But you won't know that unless you actually checked all other solutions. Okay. I'm showing H2 right now, which is this other green one. How does H2 compare to H1? Better, worse, what? Better. Is it still admissible or not admissible? Admissible. So if you get to use either H1 or H2, which would you rather use? H2. Okay, I am now showing H3, which is this. How does H3 compare to H1? Better. How does H3 compare to H2? What's the technical term for being better? More informed. It's a more informed heuristic. Okay? So how does H3 compare to H2? It's better here. But it's not better here, right? Informedness means, again, admissibility as well as informedness are for all properties. For all nodes in the world, if the H is less than or equal to H star, then H is admissible. For all nodes in the world, given two admissible heuristics, H1 and H2, if H1 is greater than or equal to H2 everywhere, then H1 is more informed. And you talk about informedness only for admissible heuristics. So H5, you don't talk about informedness at all because there's no point in having informedness when you're not guaranteed optimality. Okay? If you're only interested in reducing the number of nodes expanded and you don't care about completeness and optimality, what's the best heuristic? You want to get done fast. No, just think of the very best heuristic in the entire universe. That'll get you done fast. What? Yes. Infinity. I'm done. I don't know. And then you don't have to think anymore. Right? My son knows this. So if you ask him any question, waste time thinking about it, you know, you spend a lot of time. So right away say, I don't think there's an answer. Okay, and it doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong, because I told you that optimality and completeness don't matter. So H equal to infinity, pure pessimism, is a great thing in terms of saving CPU cycles. Okay, so that's why we don't talk about informedness of inadmissible heuristics. Okay, so now here is a funny situation. H2 and H3, you kind of see that H3 is better in some places, but it's not really better across the board. H2 is better in some places, but it's not really better across the board. Can you think of some simple, if you actually can compute both these heuristics, is there some way in which you can get a better heuristic than each of them? Max. Why not sum? You die. right? Because if you sum, you might go over H star. Max, you're guaranteed to be better than each of them, or equal, better or equal to each of them. So when you do max, what are you doing? You're taking the outer envelope of these two curves. It's nice to think of this picture because, you know, H looks like a function only in one place. You know, you tend to think of heuristics as if they have just values for each node, you know, just for one node. But we are talking about their properties across the entire node space, entire search space. And that's what this tries to show. Okay? So the max of H2, H3 is more informed than H2 as well as H3. Okay? That's it. Think about this. Yes, sir. No, you tell me. Here is H star.
I don't know.
No. You should know. it's an ungraded pop quiz. So you have to know. So admissibility is always in terms of, did you ever cross the true distance? If you are pessimistic about how far you have to go, even once, then you are not admissible. And pessimism and optimism are described with respect to reality, which you don't happen to know yet. But I showed you here H star, you know, I'm an oracle, I'm telling you what H star is. And so with respect to that, H5 is dead, so is H4. H4 is much better behaved than H5, but it's just equally dead, in the sense it doesn't get the admissibility badge. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Okay. So any questions, any other questions? Yes. So the idea is, I keep saying this in all my courses, and I'll say it for the first time in this course, and I'll say it many, many times during this course. What's the main difference between a computer scientist and a hacker? One knows what is the requirement for having certain properties and then gives them up. The other doesn't know, doesn't care. Okay? We, as computer science majors, need to care as to what we need to do to get optimality. Sometimes you may decide to give it up. Okay? In fact, you will find that in most real scenarios, unless there is an extreme reason for ensuring optimality, you would do exactly what you said, which is, in fact, H4 is not a particularly good heuristic because it's too close to zero most of the time. But suppose I have a heuristic which goes like this, almost follows H star, but once in its life it just crosses H star, etc., and then still is higher than any of these guys. There is, and in fact, a classic case of that is what you said, sum. If you have two admissible heuristics, max is guaranteed to be admissible. But sum, there is a temptation to sum it, because the bigger the number, the better you are in terms of reducing the search. And you'll see that in many cases, actually people sum them, knowing fully well that you're no longer guaranteed to be optimal. But then they can also do one of two things. One is, for example, you can talk about what are the classes of problems where summing, what are the classes of problems and heuristics where summing still won't lead to loss of optimality. Okay? So the main thing in, you know, I think the difference between a hacker and a computer scientist is you know what it takes to be optimal before you give it up. You know what it takes to be correct before you give it up reluctantly. Okay, hackers have it much better because they don't know, they don't care. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, I'm not requiring that just because you did a computer science major, you should insist on writing optimal programs even if your world is about to end in 3 seconds. It makes no sense. Okay. Okay, so properties of A star search. We talked about A star search, and basically A star search uses H function along with the G function at G plus H, right? At G plus H, and then prioritizes the queue in terms of the F values. Okay, so the question is, and then we talked about the, you know, whether or not it's optimal, etc., to some extent last time. So let's talk a little bit more. Is it complete? A star is basically complete under all the conditions where uniform cost search is complete, right? Because H values can never be negative. H values have to be zero or higher. Okay, so the only way we can be incomplete is if there are infinitely many nodes below the F star value, which is the best valued goal node. But for a best valued goal node, F star is equal to G star, because for the goal node, H is zero by definition, right? So we said the same thing previously, that uniform cost search would be optimal as long as there's never going to be infinite number of nodes below any finite cost. And that can be guaranteed as long as each edge has a positive cost. That's all. So A star is optimal exactly under the same conditions, complete under the same conditions as uniform cost search. How about optimality? We talked a lot about it. In fact, we showed last time that in essence, there are multiple ways of doing it. One is, as long as heuristic is admissible, then you can argue that any partial path that is left on the search queue when you stop with the optimal path cannot be expanded to become better than the optimal path you have in your hand. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you picked a goal node and expanded it, now before expanding you stop because it's a goal node, then the question is, are there things on the search queue at that point of time which are partial paths which can be expanded further, and they will wind up being lower in length than what you have in hand? That's not possible, because all those partial paths are started in terms of their F values. The F value is G value up to that path, which we know for sure, plus H value, which is a known underestimate of the remaining distance. So the remaining distance is either equal or worse than your estimate, which means if you actually take the time to expand them, they can only be worse than their current F values. And with their lower F values themselves, they're already worse than what you have in hand. That's the proof. That's why A star is optimal. And you can also think of it in terms of the contours, and that's what we did last class. So you can think of A star as, if uniform cost search is searching in the concentric circle contours of distances G equal to 1, 1.1, etc., etc. Now A star is doing it in the contours of F values. Okay, and if you do local consistency correction using the path max for the heuristics, then those contours do have the property that before you expand the fi plus 1th contour, you must have finished all the nodes on the fi contour. So you couldn't have missed a node with a lower f value. There's no way. Okay, that's another way of thinking about it. How about time for A star search? We looked at, in fact, one of the interesting things is you have two extreme cases for A star search, right? H equal to 0, what is A star search? If H equal to 0, A star search is uniform cost search. So that's clearly exponential because it's just blind search, and blind search is exponential. What's the best case scenario? H equal to H star. If H equal to H star, then what does A star search do? It goes straight to the goal node. So it still has to expand nodes that are of the order of the path to the goal node. So if the goal node is at depth D, not cost, but the depth D, then it just needs to do of order of D expansions. Okay? So that's the best case. This is the worst case. What's the average case? That's what you're really interested in. In general, if one is exponential, one is polynomial, average case is not going to be nice to you. It will be still exponential. That's what you found in the depth first search too. On one side, if you're lucky and your goal node is on the leftmost, you know, leftmost deepest child, depth first goes right there and finds it. It will only do D expansion. If your goal node is in the other end, then it will do exponential number of expansions. And we talked about average. I mean, you have, and basically that's again up to, you know, exponential. So it turns out that not surprisingly, A star search is exponential on the average case, but what we would like to do is really, you do know that I want to think of it in terms of the error between H star and H. Suppose I'm running with a admissible heuristic H. Okay, what I would like to do is, I know that if H is directly equal to H star, I do linear number of expansions. Okay, if it is equal to zero, which is the farthest it can be, no admissible heuristic can be farther from H star than the H star's own value, maximum value, right? In that case, it does exponential number of expansions. So what I would really like to think of is H star minus H, somehow the difference. Okay, and how fast does the number of expansions increase as the difference increases? Is there some hope? Okay, turns out there isn't that much hope. Okay, turns out that if you take the relative error between H star and H, which is H star minus H by H. Okay, then the total number of nodes expanded would be B power, the relative error of the heuristics times the depth D. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so any error, you will become exponential. Only at H equal to H star would you be linear. So from the worst case scenario, things don't look all that great. Okay? Finally, space. Okay, I mean, again, even though it's exponential, it can still be much better than, you know, B power D is much worse than B power 0.5D, which itself is much worse than B power 0.0001D. So they're really growing very slowly, but still they're exponential. Okay, so in practice, it does make a difference that the rate of growth has been slowed down with a good heuristic such that you are able to solve larger problems before you grow old and die. That's all that matters, ultimately. You understand? So your horizon, the solvability horizon, is being extended because the heuristics are being used. Okay, so you don't, it's too magical to expect that something which is growing exponentially will start growing linearly. That's not likely to happen. Okay, instead of growing like this, it starts growing like this, I start growing like this, I start growing like this. These are the best case scenarios you expect. Okay, but that does mean that, you know, given a certain amount of time, you are able to solve more problems now. Okay. Space. What about A star search space? We know that the best case scenario for space is depth first search, which is linear space. Worst case scenario for space is breadth first search, which is exponential space. The question is, and for space, all you want is the maximum space you can take, not the average space. Because if your program runs for a million years, and as I said, only on, you know, for one particular second on a particular year of a particular month, it requires one byte more than what you have. It dies. So you need to care about maximum space. So what's the worst case maximum space for A star search? Exponential. Why? Because H can be equal to 0 in A star search. A star is a family of algorithms. Okay, for depending on the H value. So since H can be equal to 0, it will be uniform cost search in that case, and it will take exponential space. And H equal to H star, it is guaranteed to take linear space. For any other H, A star can take exponential space. Now, we don't expect to be able to win the time game. Okay, but we did win the space game last time, right? For the blind search, we were able to win the space game by doing this iterative deepening depth first search. Can we do that for A star search so that the space will be, you know, linear? Turns out yes. Okay, we will talk about, basically we will do what's called iterative deepening A star search. Let's try to guess what it would be. So IDDFS, basically if you have a tree like this, IDDFS, which is iterative deepening depth first search, went like that, like that, like that, and then for each iteration it did depth first search. What do you think IDA star will do? The common temptation is to say it will also go iterations, but it will do A star search in each iteration. You have to tell yourself that can't make sense. If you do A star search, you're dead. It doesn't matter when you do it. In terms of space, if you do A star search, you're dead. The only way you can win the space game is with depth first search. So even though IDA star, the name makes you think that actually you are just basically having this kind of same nice, you know, iteration, but in each iteration you wind up doing A star search instead of depth first search, really what you do is you use the A star ideas to set the iteration, and within each iteration you do depth first search. Previously you set these cutoffs for IDDFS using the depth. In A star, what is the equivalent of depth in A star? F value. So you set the cutoffs using the F value. Okay. So now the problem is the following thing. You know how the depth increases. Depth starts from 0, next depth will be 1, next depth will be 2, next depth will be 3, and so on. How does F value increase? You know, it starts from 0. What's the next cutoff? What's the next cutoff? Well, you can do it. You can find out. Okay, so what you would wind up doing is, in the beginning, you will assume F cutoff is equal to 0. You just take the nodes, you know, and expand them, and expand their children, and if their children happen to have F values greater than the F cutoff, then they are not part of the tree. Except you will remember the child which just missed the current cutoff. So that is the best child. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if in fact my current F cutoff, let's say, is 12.57. Okay? While I'm doing, you know, the search in that cutoff, as I expand nodes, I make the child for this node. And if the child happens to have an F value more than 12.57, it's not part of the search for now. Except what I will do is, I will say next cutoff is equal to, what is the next cutoff? Is equal to minimum of the current cutoff, minimum of the current value of the next cutoff. So you start by saying next cutoff equal to also 12.57, and then you keep iteratively updating it and say it would be minimum of the current value of the next cutoff and the F value of the rejected node. If you do this, by the time you are done going through all the children, right, you would know who was the child that was closest to the current F cutoff. That you have to increase your F by at least that much, so that in the next iteration you will see a few more nodes. You understand? If you don't change your F cutoff, you'll never see any more nodes and you die. I mean, in a sense, you stop basically. You know, if you didn't find search, you know, goal in this particular cutoff, you know, iteration, then you don't know what to do. Previously depth would be increased by depth plus 1, and so more nodes will come. Now you increase f incremental this way by the amount equal to at least let the next highest, the next closest node come in. So it's just part of the, it's just part of your algorithm. Okay. So basically, the next one might look like this. So it's, for example, notice the cutoff might well be effectively that you, only this node and this node are going to be searched in this iteration. Okay. And then next one might look like that. Next one might look like that. All you need is in between each iteration, new nodes are coming. They are not equal depth. They are not at all equal depth. Okay, they are equal f values. And f value depends on depth, I mean the g value and the h value. Okay? And in each of these iterations, you do depth first search. And you get the linear space because you do depth first search. Yeah? Okay? So, that's the idea. Yes, sir.
So that means that in IDA star we have a local value of heuristic for each iteration instead of a constant global value that we used to have in IDA star.
What?
The S star value, I mean the F value changes for every iteration.
No. A star doesn't have a cutoff at all. IDA star has a cutoff. It's called the F cutoff. So normal A star search, basically whenever it picks a node for expansion, it generates its nodes, puts them onto the queue, prioritized by the F value. IDA star, on the other hand, won't even put those nodes on the queue unless their F value is better than the current F cutoff, I mean lower than the current F cutoff. And the way it manages the queue is not by prioritization of F, it's first in, I mean last in, first out. So IDA star is actually depth first search, where the new, every tree is generated using the F values. It's a very interesting combination of A star ideas and depth first search ideas. And it makes sense, nothing else makes sense if you want linear space, because only one search in the world can give you linear space. One systematic search in the world can give you linear space, and that's depth first search. We'll actually talk in a little bit about what's called a non-systematic or local search, which can get by with just one byte of memory. Okay, but it's not systematic. Okay, and then, yeah. Okay, so here's the question. Will you get, what are the properties? Will you get linear memory? Yeah? Okay, the other thing is how many iterations? For the iterative deepening depth first search, if the goal appears at depth D, the total number of iterations would be D. What's the number of iterations for the iterative deepening A star search? You wanted to say something. Yeah, so what is it? B power D. Okay? IDA star is, can really get you. Okay? Because your F cutoff increases a little by little by little to just get one more person in. You know, the other day, I think, when I was in Hawaii, when I got this T-shirt, there was this one nice shave ice store where people were standing, and it's supposed to be the best shave ice store. And then, you know, this guy basically does his thing, you know, extremely slowly. It's almost as if he doesn't care about the business. And there's like a long line. And we would be hoping that, you know, he will treat a huge number of people, and then the next huge number of people will go in. But what happens is after 1 hour, one more person will go in. The next 1 hour, one more person will go in. Okay? And I didn't like that. I mean, it took forever, you know. But that's more or less what can happen in IDA star search. One new node will come for each iteration. That's the worst case scenario. That's the worst case scenario. Okay? But we hope that it won't happen. In fact, you know, depending on the kind of things that, you know, if in fact, one of the interesting things is, if, let's say, here's the idea. I talked about iterative deepening depth first search, and then I talked about iterative deepening A star search. Why didn't I talk about iterative deepening uniform cost search? You'd ask yourself that. Should I have not talked about it? And what will happen if I talk about it? How does iterative deepening uniform cross search work? You should be able to figure this out. Instead of F value, you just do it in terms of G value, or you still do it in terms of F value where H equal to 0 all the time. So even though nobody talks about it, there is in fact an algorithm called IDDUC star. I mean IDDUC, iterative deepening uniform cross search. It too is like IDA star, except H is always equal to 0. And it too would have this property that in the worst case it can do B power D iterations. But if you are doing iterative deepening uniform cross search on something like the tile puzzle, do you really believe that there will be exponential number of iterations? Why not? G is increasing discretely, not discretely in the sense you don't know that it's changing, but discretely in the sense it's increasing by integer amounts. It's beautiful if things increase by integer amounts, because there can't be, you know, exponential number of iterations. Okay, but even in those cases, IDDA star has more likelihood of being exponential number of iterations, because even if the physical problem has integer distances, heuristics can be any old thing. Heuristics can have square roots. They can be irrational numbers. All they need to be are positive numbers. Do you understand? So in fact, this is a bigger problem for IDA star search. Okay, but nobody really talks about it because we hope that we will normally go with reasonable heuristics which are sort of integral valued. But that's not required. Even if the problem, physical problem, has integral distances, that doesn't mean that the heuristics must have them. Okay? There, of course, one problem with this idea star, the good idea is that it takes linear space. The bad idea is that it can take exponential number of iterations. So in fact, the great property you had in the homework, which by the way is due today, is that in the iterative deepening depth first search to depth first search, it's only b plus 1 by b minus 1. If you try to do the same kind of analysis here, you are sunk, because in the worst case, it can be exponentially more number of expansions. Okay? Now, so the question then is, can you get a slightly better idea than iterative deepening A star search? There are, in fact, many, many, many better ideas. Nobody talks to you about them in intro to AI courses normally. You should at least know IDA star search. But I'll show you one idea. There are many other ideas, okay? It's not that hard to think about. In fact, IDA star search, if anything, is just too conservative. You know, if your goal is in depth 30, it is going to keep only 30 times the number of nodes, and the size of the node. Let's say each node takes 1 byte. And if your goal is expected to be at most at depth 30, then IDA star will never take more than 30 bytes, right? Even Bill Gates, even when he was drunk, said each computer needs at least 640 kilobytes of disk space. I mean, I don't know how many of you remember that, you know, Bill Gates has said that nobody would need more than 640 kilobytes. That's why, you know, everything is on this funny looking floppy disk. And then he started writing these word programs which take the world to actually store. But the point is, nobody has just 30 bytes of memory. So why be so conservative? You normally have 4 gigabytes, in fact 32 gigabytes, you know, depending on how much, you know, it means to you. You can have lots and lots of main memory. You can also have secondary memory. While you don't have 30 gazillion billion petabytes of memory, neither do you have only 30 bytes of memory. So the question is, use as much of the memory as possible without killing yourself. And the idea for that would be what computer systems do, right? The operating system also has the same problem. If left to itself, it would like to remember every possible page in the main memory. Okay? And if it's a really conservative operating system, it will just keep one page in the main memory. I think that's what Windows does, because after a while, you know, although my programs all add up to only like 3 megabytes, the total amount of space supposedly used by the operating system is 300 gigabytes. Okay, I don't know how that happens, but the point is that you want to use the main memory and keep putting stuff into the main memory, and up until the point main memory is almost full, at which point you page somebody out so that the new guy can be put in. And you talked about all these strategies. These are the caching strategies, right? And you talked about least recently used, most frequently used, all this fun stuff. You can do the same thing for search too. Okay? So there is this idea called SMSTAR, which is described in the textbook. You can read it. And the simple idea it has is keep expanding. Keep expanding. So it starts with a bound called a memory bound called node, max nodes. And it'll keep expanding until the open list currently contains more than max, I mean, currently contains equal to max number of nodes. Then to get anybody in, you need to boot somebody out. Who are you going to boot out? The most obvious thing to do is boot the least promising guy out. From the A star terminology, the least promising node is the one with the highest F value. Highest F value. So you boot that highest F value node out. And then you put the new node in. One difference, which is, now basically when you remove the highest F value node, then remember that in fact memory is not just the open list as we discussed on the blog, it is also all the parent nodes to whom you put the pointer. So when you actually removed a loser, then the parent of that loser node still remains. So you basically remember at the parent node the F value of the node that you just booted out. So that later on, if everything else on the open queue starts looking worse than this F value, then you re-expand this parent again to get that node back. You understand? Ultimately, you have to re-expand, but this way, you only re-expand on demand when really you need to. It's a smart idea. Okay, and SMS star beats the pants off of IDA star. It's a more painful algorithm to write, but it's much faster in normal sense because it actually uses the existing memory. There are many other ideas for using the existing memory, but you know, in fact, while reducing time is much harder, using a given amount of memory is much, much more feasible. You just need to be clever. Okay, so now I come to the main topic of today's class. Basically majority topic of today's class, which is, we talked about heuristics, we talked a little about where they're coming from last time, we gave you examples of tile puzzle heuristics, for example, right, and the examples of heuristics in the grid search, which is in terms of path planning heuristics and so on. What I really want to know is, I don't want to depend on me getting, you know, jolts of lightning, you know, when I get this genius idea as to what's the next heuristic. Okay, nothing should be magic. Anything that works should not be magic. There should be a systematic way of getting even things that look magical. So the question is, what's the theory of generating heuristics? How do I go about brute force generating heuristics? And the rest of today's class basically is to remove the glamour from the heuristics. By the time you're done, you think, my God, this is what heuristics is. It looks just as ugly as normal search. But you would be much better off because you know when the magic is removed, then you're better off. Okay? So let's look at that. Okay. So where do the heuristics come from? Here is the most important point to remember. Heuristics come from relaxed problems. You take a problem, you relax it. A problem contains some constraints. Okay? So solve it, you know, with respect to, you know, the constraints of the current problem. And if you want to get a heuristic, then you remove some of the constraints. Then the resulting problem would be hopefully easier to solve than the original problem. And it would be the case that the cost of that resulting problem, the cost you got of the solution for that resulting problem would be less than or equal to the real problem solution. That's it. And then what's interesting is how much of a consequence this particular little understanding has. Okay? So let's talk about that. For path planning on the plane, how do I relax it? I have obstacles. Okay? How do I relax the obstacles? Assume they go away. If they go away, then it's just straight line distance. Because once the obstacles go away, the problem would be finding distance between two points on the plane. That's just straight line distance. That's the shortest point, shortest distance. And you're guaranteed that would not be any worse than the real cost of going from one node, one point to another point. For eight puzzle problem, what can I do? I basically assume the ability to move tiles directly to the place they want to go. Okay, that's one abstraction, that's one relaxation. If I do that, I get the heuristic called number of misplaced tiles. I can also say, well, really what I need to do is when I'm moving, I can't just fly. I have to move step by step by step. If I do that, I will get Manhattan distance. The interesting thing is, this is a bigger relaxation than this. Okay? Smaller relaxations will be close to reality, so there would be, if you solve that problem, that would actually, the cost of that problem would be close to the H star value. But solving that problem would be harder, because it's just as bad as the original problem. Okay? Big abstractions would make it easy to solve the problem, but the H values you get are likely to be far away from H star. There is actually one more heuristic here, which is assume everything is possible. There's just nothing, you know, standing between me and goal. I'm already in goal. Then I would get the heuristic called H equal to zero. It's very hard, very easy to compute, right? Because you don't even have to write a little program to solve the, you know, to get the heuristic. But you get what you pay for. You do exponential number of expansion. Okay? How about traveling salesperson? That can be seen as a problem too. Traveling salesperson problem is you have a graph, you know, where there are vertices corresponding to cities, there are weighted edges corresponding to the distances between the cities, and this traveling salesperson is trying to find the shortest, lowest cost circuit through this graph, which will visit all the cities, sell her wares or his wares in that particular city, go to the next city and so on, and come back to the home city. The question is, what's the order in which you do this circuit such that you would wind up traveling the least distance total? That's a traveling salesperson problem, right? And it's a known NP-hard problem. In fact, by the way, most problems, as I said, most problems that you wind up actually continuing to solve as, you know, search problems, they happen not to be polynomial. Because if they are polynomial, what happens is that the perfect heuristic itself has to be polynomially computable. In which case, then you don't have to think of it as search. You can, you know, compile the heuristic computation into the search process itself, and you will get a specialized algorithm, such as your sorting, bubble sort, your quick sort, and all that stuff. Okay, so most problems in AI that we will look at would be normally exponential or worse. Okay, and traveling salesperson, for example, is an NP-hard problem. Okay, and what would be a relaxation? One idea would be, for example, a reasonable relaxation that actually seems to work quite well in practice is relax the circuit requirement. Relax the circuit requirement. You don't need to get back to where you started from. Then you can find a tree. In fact, you can find a minimum spanning tree of the graph. And if you take an algorithms course, you will find out, or if you already took it, you know that finding minimum spanning tree is polynomial time computation. And that can be guaranteed to be a lower bound on the actual circuit cost. Okay, trivial lower bounds are trivially easy to get because zero is a trivial lower bound. Getting good lower bounds is what good heuristics is all about. Okay, so when we are looking at this, in fact, when I'm looking at the H puzzle problem, you know, if I count the number of misplaced tiles, I have to write a program which has, you know, if I say everything is possible right away, right now, then I can write a program where I say I call h, it returns 0. Very good. I don't have to write a big program at all. Here I have to actually look at the node and count the number of misplaced tiles. Here I have to look at the node, count how many places each of the misplaced tile has to travel to get to its real place. If you think of the amount of time your computation is going to take, it will be a little more here than here. And this is a little more here than there. And you can actually see that as the abstractions are closer and closer to reality, that means you do less and less of an abstraction, the harder and harder it would be to solve the problem, solve the relaxed problem, but the better and better your estimates are going to be. That means they're closer and closer to H star. Okay, so here actually is the same kind of analysis, but now just for the path planning problem. Okay, so I have these obstacles, and if this is initial state, this is goal state. One idea for abstraction is disappearing act. All obstacles disappeared. Then it would be just straight line distance. Okay? The other idea is to basically what I would call a circular abstraction, because these obstacles can have irregular shapes. Okay, so I can put circular abstraction. What's the closest circle that approximates this obstacle? I can do polygonal abstraction. I can do a polygonal abstraction with the number of polygon nodes, triangular abstraction versus quadrilateral abstraction versus hexagonal abstraction, etc. And as I increase the number of sides for the polygon, my abstraction becomes closer and closer to reality. That means they're actually closer and closer to the actual, obstacle shapes. And then if I'm solving these problems first and get the bound from here, they will be closer to the real cost. Okay? It's clear that solving this is very easy, and solving this is a full problem. In fact, this is a not bad idea too. Just don't abstract anything at all. Solve the problem every time and use it as a heuristic to solve the problem again. You just call it a very dumb idea, because instead of finding path from S to G, you're finding optimal paths from everywhere to everywhere. It's unnecessary. Okay? So as you go from here to here, the cost you spend in computing the heuristic is increasing. That's the heuristic computation cost. But the base level search itself, which is the A star search that is decided by the number of expansions you are doing, that is reducing. Because the better the heuristic, the fewer expansions you do. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you have a very interesting process, which is as you go this way, one cost is increasing, another cost is reducing. And what is the total cost for the search? It's not that you can't say, let me think now for my heuristic and don't count, stop the clock. You don't get to do that. There's the same clock for computing the heuristic and doing the search. The total cost is a sum of these two. That brings up the issue, where do you think is the best search? Best search is not likely to be in the ends, it's somewhere in the middle. I'll get there in the next slide. Before I go away, can somebody tell me, when I am inscribing polygons and circles, why am I inscribing? Why can't I circumscribe? Yes, sir. What? Yes. Couple what you know from the theory to what you know from other sources. Okay. The reason I have to inscribe is that if I circumscribe, right? So there could be a possibility that a circumscribing circles wind up touching each other. So you think there is no way between those obstacles. But the obstacles are in such a way that there is actually a small corridor behind them that you can get through. That means the heuristic will say a certain problem is unsolvable. That means it overestimated the cost, and so it winds up losing optimality. It's a beautiful point, because in geometry, circumscribing obstacles winds up being against the philosophy of ensuring admissibility. Okay? Would people who do this for a living in path planning, do they never do circumscribing? No, once in a while they do too. Again, the difference is they know when they are circumscribing that they can't assume optimality anymore. Okay? This is the picture I'm telling you. Okay, and this is the picture that you should remember whenever you are thinking of how does the search cost depend upon heuristic computation cost. And if you remember this, you are way better off than this entire field was less than 10 years back, because it took a long time for people to figure this out. Okay, so the idea is, if I write down heuristics, this x-axis now corresponds to different heuristics, with the idea that as I go from here to here, the level of abstraction is reducing. Here it's like totally abstracted, h equal to 0. And here it's not abstracted at all. That means you're solving the real problem, so which means you'll get h equal to h star. And I'll only focus on admissible heuristics. Okay, so this is h star here. Now, if I look at the search cost, this is a qualitative picture, obviously. I'm not talking about any specific problem. If this is the case, then the number of nodes expanded by the base level search, you expect it to exponentially fall down as the heuristic becomes more and more informed. But to get it to be more and more informed, you need to spend more and more time computing the heuristic for each node. And that is coming from the same pocket. Do you understand? Okay, so the total cost of the search is the sum of these two anti-correlated exponential curves. So it would sort of look more like this. So if somebody asks you, what's the best kind of heuristic? It's not this. It's not this either. It's wherever this is. This is the best heuristic. Now the problem is, you won't know for any given problem what that particular heuristic happens to be. Okay? But you do have to have some intuitions. And your biases can sometimes harm you. And the entire field of AI had the bias that heuristics should be easy to compute. Should be easy to compute. What that would mean is that you believe that the world is in such a way that this curve is going to have minimum here. Why should that be the case? Shouldn't you check? Okay, if somebody says heuristics should be easy to compute, then they are making an assumption on the way the world works. Okay, it's like Einstein saying God won't play dice, and then Niels Bohr told Einstein, stop telling God what to do. Right? Don't tell world what to do. See what the world does actually. Right? So what's interesting is, and most people, doing AI cursorily, would still think that heuristics must be much, much cheaper to compute than the total search. That's not necessary at all. In fact, one of the interesting things that people found is, for many, many problems, this minimum here, the best case scenario, occurs for heuristics which also are exponential cost to compute. It's just that once you do that, the total cost of the search is significantly reduced. That's where the total cost becomes minimum. It's counterintuitive if you are biased by this old idea that God won't play dice, or God would be nice to us, or the world would be so nice that heuristics would be cheap to compute. Okay? And so, in fact, I will show you a heuristic in today's class for tile puzzle problems, which doesn't look like a heuristic at all. Because if you think heuristic should be, I look at the problem and I'll know what the number is, it's not that. A heuristic really is just a function. And a function is a big lookup table. If this is the state, this is the value. This is the state, this is the value. If you happen to have analytical heuristic functions which are cheap to compute, you won't actually store it as a huge big function. You just compute it on demand. If not, you can pre-compute it, store it in this huge big table, and use it as needed. And all that your boss cares is, did you get done faster than, with that fast to, how fast you get done computing the heuristic won't get you any medals. You only get medals for solving the problem fast. Okay? remember this slide. I mean, remember every slide, but just remember this slide definitely. Okay. So let's do these tile puzzles and crazy heuristics for the tile puzzle. Which actually is the state of the art in the kind of heuristics that are actually useful. As I said, for many problems. The best effective heuristics oftentimes are actually exponentially hard to compute. And still, they wind up still reducing the time much lower. So it's not surprising because the underlying search is exponential anyway. Right? For most problems, that's the case. Okay, so let's do, before we get to the more exponential heuristics, let's look at, let's remember our intuitions about misplaced tiles and the Manhattan distance. Okay, so here is the start state, here is the goal state. So the number of misplaced tiles for this would be 7. You just count the number of tiles which are not in the right position. This is the goal state. Okay, and the number of the Manhattan distance is essentially the number of spaces that each tile has to move. Knowing that it's a Manhattan kind of a situation, so you go down, sideways, etc. Okay, and for each tile, these are the numbers. In fact, one has to move, one is here, it needs to be here, so it needs to move this way and this way. So it needs to move two places. For about five is here and needs to move there, so it needs to move 1, 2, 3, 4. You add them all up, you get 18. Both are admissible. And 18 is a hugely bigger number than 7, which is infinitely larger number than 0. Right? So h equal to 0, you would die. You would never even solve any reasonable tile puzzle problems. Unless they're like, you are looking at 8 puzzle. This is an 8 puzzle situation. And we'll talk more about 15, and 24 is already hard to solve for most search algorithms. Okay, this is brute force combinatorics. Okay, so clearly you would assume that Manhattan distance is a godsend, because if you use that, you can solve problems much faster for the tile puzzle. Okay, so performance on the 15 puzzle. So we looked at here 8 puzzle. So if you use the same ideas on the 15 puzzle, which is a bigger puzzle, then for the random 15 puzzle instances, the first time they could be solved optimally was only in 1985. I know some of you are not born then, but I think, at least you know people who are born there, right? And it's only recently that we were actually able to solve 15 puzzle random instances optimally using Manhattan distance. Okay? And they use, by the way, IDA star, because they may have all the time in the world, but in 1985, they definitely didn't have all the space in the world. This was still the 640 KB is more than enough for everybody time frame. Okay? And then optimal solution length for 15 puzzle averaged 53 moves. You are talking 53 in the exponent, b power d, where b is somewhere around 4, right? Because it's little less than 4, because the blank can move 4 different directions. So we are talking about 4 power 53 is the size of the search space. That's pretty big for those days. Okay, and they still were able to solve it. Solve it means, they were done at some point of time. Karp, by the way, is a guy who still does tile puzzles, and we'll talk about him a little bit more. But he just loves search, and so he keeps talking about tile puzzles, Rubik's Cube, all these things. Okay, they were at that time developing, doing 400 million nodes generated on the average before the optimal solution was found. And average solution time is about 50 seconds on current machines, which I think this slide was copied about 3 years back. So 50 seconds 3 years back. So it's much fewer seconds now. That's the 15 puzzle. Just using Manhattan distance heuristic. Okay. So you made something that was impossible to solve solvable by using a Manhattan distance heuristic. So what happens if I use Manhattan distance heuristic to solve 24 puzzle problem? Because I'm not saying that I'm a puzzle maniac, but we can see where things start breaking. 24 is still not that hard to imagine, right? And what happens is, to solve a 24 puzzle instance, IDA star with Manhattan distance would take about 65,000 years on the average. Again, obviously that's too big a number. It was 3 years back, so I believe that will only take 15,000 years now. Okay? We are much better off. But we don't have that much time. And we are talking 24 puzzles. Okay? Now, what can I do such that I can solve? You know, again, one of the things that many students who come to AI course see, and in fact, you know, right after this, we'll talk about the project. The first project is going to be released as of today, and you will be start working on that using this style puzzle problems. Okay? And one thing you will realize is, in most other classes, you spend tons of time debugging the program, and the first time it runs, you then say it ran. Okay? That's because you are solving problems that are trivial to solve in some sense. In the sense, their complexity was not much more than low-order polynomial. Things like tile puzzle problems are exponential problems. Okay, I'm asking you only to look at 8 puzzle for the first project, so it's not particularly hard. But if you have a reasonably ancient laptop, and if you have some little mistake, and you are doing cycling in the search space, you know, you would say, I'm done, but I couldn't complete running anything. That's no good. And all the projects in this class would be based not just on the code running, but running the code on the problems, evaluating the performance, analyzing the performance. So if you just done such that it will work on one problem, you basically only went maybe 40% of the way. So make sure that you take that into account. You know, you're not done when your code doesn't have errors. That's when you're just getting warmed up. Okay, but that's the reality. We're talking 65,000 years, so we have time. Okay? Make sure that you have to. Okay, so now the question, of course, is what can I do to cut down the time? I mean, the part what I'm going to talk about now is basically this idea of improving heuristics that can solve these kinds of problems too. This is an advanced idea. You don't have to do it in the required part of the project one, but it will be asked to, you would be asked to consider doing it as an extra credit portion if you want. So understand this, and then you can decide whether to do it. So the problem with Manhattan distance, what's wrong with Manhattan distance heuristic? It seems to be better than the previous heuristics, right? It seems to be better than the previous heuristics. The problem with the Manhattan distance heuristic is, when a tile is moving, it is taking into account how much distance it has to travel, but it's assuming that it can walk on the tops of other tiles. So it just says, pardon me, and walk on the tops of other tiles and then get to its place. While the other people are also saying, pardon me, and going around other tiles. Ain't possible. Right? We are all in this connected world. I can't walk over you to get to that. That door if there is a fire. Although you should remember that teachers, women, and children first if there is a fire. Okay. But anyway, the issue then is, the real problem is that you are assuming that each tile moves independently. That's the problem. They're all connected. Now, if you say, well, yeah, they're all connected, then you've given up. Basically, everything is just as hard as the original problem. So the question is, can you start talking about limited amounts of interactions between tiles? You can say, you know, on one extreme is, you can say, I'm the only person. I'll just walk over people's heads. On the other extreme, you'll say, the place is full of people. I can't do a thing. Let me wait until everybody leaves, and then the fireplace completely burns down and I die. Okay, so the question then is, can I take some parts into account? So in particular, let's say, what I can do is, I can say, well, I will say certain amounts of independences. I mean, I will assume certain I won't. Okay, in the example that I have, let's say, what I can do is, suppose you're trying to compute how much time does it take for everybody to get out of this room. And if you count that time based on the independence assumption, you will grossly underestimate it, because you're thinking everybody is walking over everybody's heads. And normally when there's a fire, we'll basically run into each other, there's a huge amount of traffic jam, and we'll all burn to death. Right? That's normally what happens. Okay, in, when actual accidents happen, we get into all sorts of traffic jams. So that's why they try to teach you when accidents happen, stand and go in an orderly fashion. Now, between the two extremes, I can say, look, when there's a fire, I want to save myself, my three best buddies, and maybe the teacher. Okay, let's assume that we can walk over the rest of the other guys. Just make sure that these four people will get out. It's a harder problem than assuming. So when you do this, if you're trying to save your best buddies, you can't also walk over them, because then they would be saved, but in a pulp fashion, right? So you have to take, you are modeling them, but you are ignoring the rest of the things. If you do that, you will get an abstraction which is less abstract than what the Manhattan distance was doing, but more abstract than the full problem. And these are called, essentially, for the case of tile puzzles, these are called the pattern database heuristics. Pattern database heuristics, okay? Here is the idea. Basically, assume that your friends are just this tile. So basically, you have the final configuration that really is needed is everybody to get out of the room, right? So final configuration for the tile puzzle is blank. In this guy's case, blank should be in the first tile, I believe. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. You decided that I don't want to save everybody. What I want to save is just myself and my friends. I want to get them to their correct position. And I'll assume then, before you start killing people, you assume they don't have names. Remember that during the Holocaust, people's names were removed and they were given numbers. That's what you do if you want to kill people. And if you want to kill the nodes, you remove their names, because then they'll all be equivalent. Okay, and so you don't want to know who you are stepping on, other than as long as they're not your friends. Okay, so that's a beautiful idea. So now, in the beginning, my friends were all over the place. In this room, they were in different places. In this tile puzzle, they were in all these places. To get them to the right position here, the minimum, the Manhattan distance says 19 moves. I said mean distance, unfortunately, but Manhattan distance says 19 moves are needed to just get my friends to the right places. But the real number required to get my friends to the right places, assuming I can walk over other guys, that means I don't really care about where the other people will be. I just say, pardon me, and you know, go through them, but I don't care whether they finally, they're all in the right position or not. Okay? That would be 31 moves. So now 31 is still a lower bound on the total number of moves required to save everybody, to get all tiles into the right position, right? The number of moves required to get all tiles into the correct position has to be bigger than or equal to the number of moves required to get a subset of them to the correct position. That's all I'm saying. Okay, similarly here, if they were in this kind of a position, to get them again to the correct position, Manhattan distance says 20 moves, the real number is 28. And for this case, the Manhattan distance is 17, the real number is 27. If I got these real numbers, these are better lower bounds. And if somehow I can compute these, and computing these numbers is going to be exponential, but it won't be as bad as solving the entire tile puzzle. Because, as I said, I'm only saving myself from my friends. And all I'm saying to the rest of the people is, pardon me, excuse me, and getting out. Okay, so now, so in the case of pattern database heuristics, which is an idea that only came in 96, essentially, and a pattern database is a complete set of such positions. So for what you care about is, what are all the possible configurations your friends could be in the original time? And if they are, what is the time take, number of moves taken to get them to the right position? And you decide your friends is your pattern. You can decide any kind of pattern. You like this pattern, I can like this pattern, somebody else can like this pattern, it doesn't matter. But any pattern which is more than one slide long is going to be better than what most of the Manhattan distance, etc. do, because it takes into account some of the interactions between the tiles. Okay. Now, this basically what this is now saying is, this is a new search problem. To get this compute, to get this number, you have to solve this new search problem where it doesn't matter who are here. So there can be exponential number of configurations where your friends are safe and all of them are goal nodes. It doesn't matter what the other guys are doing. This is why the goal test will essentially make sure that the pattern is in the right place. Okay? Now, in trying to solve this, in this particular case, a pattern database is a complete set of such positions. So if I have this 7-tile pattern database for this problem, 7-tile pattern database, these are 7 tiles. If I have 7 friends in a 15 puzzle world, okay, then the function, the complete function, will require 519 million entries. 519 million entries, because it turns out your friends can be in 519 different configurations in the initial state. And they all need to be in this pattern configuration in the final state. 519 million looks like a loser idea compared to something like Manhattan distance heuristic. It looks like heuristics that are ugly and hairy. But they work. And they work in the only thing that matters, which is the total time taken is the lowest. You don't have to live for 65,000 years to solve 24 puzzle problems anymore. All you needed to do was to be clever and realize that the God didn't make the world, that the world doesn't just conform to what I think it should be, but it is what it is. Okay? So, in this particular case, heuristics, so there are 590 million, you just go ahead and compute all of them before the problem starts. Take that time into account. And then solve the problem using this heuristic table. You will still do better than 65,000 years. In fact, you will be doing enough, better enough that you can write papers about it. That means it got done in like maybe at most 3-4 days, which is way better than 65,000 years. Okay? So, pre-computing pattern databases. This is the last point I will make, and you should, you know, those of you who want to try to solve this, do this in the extra credit portion for the project one, should understand this. You know, there is a paper I put up on the online that you can read too. The textbook doesn't talk about this. I think you need to understand that heuristics can be hairy and still be very useful, because our biases ultimately kill us. If we think that people who are shabbily dressed are all stupid, then we might miss an Einstein or two. Okay, that's the worry. Okay, so the entire database can be computed with one backward breadth first search from the goal. Because there's no point in computing each of these separately. Each of these separately, because there's large number of them will wind up having repeated search. So I start from here. These are all blanked out because I don't care about their things. I generate breadth first search. And every time I see a new configuration, that is the cheapest way I could have gone to that configuration. Beautiful. It's true, it might take 3 days, but it's way better than taking, you know, 150 days. That's what all computer science is about. Okay? So you generate the entire database in one backward breadth first search from the goal. All non-pattern types are indistinguishable, but all tile moves are considered. You do have to say that one thing, you know, that I may have misled you in my example is, you don't actually walk over people. You still have to, the blank can only go if there is nobody. But the identity of the person doesn't matter. There's a beautiful scene in Schindler's List where there's this little girl who suddenly made pink in a black and white movie. That's more or less what we are talking about. Pattern database tiles are in pink, the rest of the tiles are just indistinguishable black and white. Okay? So all non-pattern tiles are indistinguishable, but all tile moves are counted. The first time each state is encountered, the total number of moves made so far is stored. And that's how you get this huge function of 519 million entries. Okay? Once computed, the same table is used for all problems with the same goal state. That's true. But if you do this, it turns out that you can actually solve 24 puzzle problem, I forgot to put that slide, essentially in minutes on the current hardware. Yeah, I don't remember, maybe hours. But it's still way, way better than 64,000, 65,000. The joke one time is that The people are still trying for 31 puzzle. The next one is no. What's the next one? Next one is 35 puzzle. Okay. And I remember that there's this one time when I was running the national conference on AI, and Karp submitted a paper, Richard Karp, the same guy you looked at previously. And then in these conferences, after the reviewers look at your paper, they can also ask questions, and then the researcher then gets to respond anonymously before a decision is made. So one of the questions is, yeah, you said this heuristic works better, how come you didn't give the answer to this problem? And Karp writes, and the reviewers won't know that this is Karp because it's a double-blind anonymous review, but I knew because I was the conference chair. And Karp writes to them saying, actually the program was running, but it just completed yesterday, and here is the number. And the review cycle takes 1 month. Okay, so but he was able to solve the problem in a month. That's pretty darn good compared to 65,000 years. You understand what I'm saying? So welcome to the new world where problems actually can take time. And you know, it's not enough for your code to work, but you have to make it more and more efficient, not in terms of just reducing a couple of go-to statements, but think of clever ways such as heuristics. Okay, so I will open the project one today. It would make significant sense for you, given our discussion, you should be able to start with it.
What is it?
It basically does tile puzzle. Essentially, you would be asked to do eight, take the eight puzzle problem and do, I think, two different searches, breadth first and ASR search. Okay, and then I also give you most of the code, and then I ask you to write only parts of the code. Okay. It will probably be due in about 3 weeks. I will set up the test.